The controversies surrounding Pope Francis have led many Catholics to rethink the papacy itself, with some transforming the Pope into a political leader to be followed in all things, and others going the other way and rejecting his authority entirely. What is the proper Catholic way to look at the role of the papacy in the church? That's what we're going to talk about today on Crisis Point. Hello, I'm Eric Sammons, your host and editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Just want to encourage people to like and subscribe to the channel. Do what you can to let other people know about it as we continue to grow the podcast. And also follow Crisis Magazine at Crisis Mag at the various social media channels. Okay, let's get right into it. We have Dr. Peter Kwasniewski here today. He has written or edited 20 books as of right now. Tomorrow will probably be more, including the one we're going to talk about the most, which is The Road from Hyperpapalism to Catholicism by... I want to make sure I pronounce it right. Is it Aruka Press?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, by Aruka Press. It's actually a two-volume series here. And it's the subtitle of it, I think, is very interesting. So it's The Road from Hyperpapalism to Catholicism. It's Rethinking the Papacy in a Time of Ecclesial Disintegration. And I, of course, was very interested in this because I, as people who follow this podcast know, I had a podcast, I think it was last September, about a year ago, called Rethinking the Papacy. And it's something that a lot of Catholics are doing. And I think if we're honest with ourselves, the very phrase rethinking the papacy should scare us on some level, because obviously the papacy is a very important aspect of Catholicism. And so we can't just, I mean, it's not for us to just say, okay, let's do a new type of papacy. So that I want to really get into that and say, what do you mean then? Let's just start off at the beginning with, what do you mean by rethink the papacy? Because isn't the papacy of divine origin and can't really be changed?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely, Eric. It's you know, the phrase rethinking the papacy, it has to be unpacked. I'm not saying the way that, you know, Hans Küng might say, let's rethink contraception or something. I'm not a dissenter at all. The fact is that there is a conception of what it means for the Pope to have full authority and for Catholics to be obliged to follow him that is a distorted conception. We can see it in a place like where Peter is. I know we'll get to that later on. But there's a distortion in the understanding of who the Pope is, what his office entails, what is his relationship with tradition, with scripture, with preceding magisterium. And this faulty or false conception of the papacy is actually very damaging to the papacy itself, because it undermines the very purpose for which our Lord instituted the office.
Right. So it probably I've been one who's actually been attacked for subtitles in my books as well, because people don't understand that you condense things and you add a fit on a cover and stuff like that. But so would it probably be better to say, not as a subtitle, but just in general, more accurate to say, rethinking false conceptions of the papacy? Is that probably what you're trying to do a better way?
Right, exactly. Although, maybe more broadly speaking, in terms of ecclesiology, our understanding of the church, we do have to ask, what is the Pope's role within the entire mystical body of Christ? Who is he the head of the church, simply speaking, simpliciter, or is he the vicar of the head of the church, who is Jesus Christ, the eternal and permanent and divine head of the church? So in a way, there's a rethinking of the papacy that has to go on, just because I think there's been a lot of sloppy and superficial thinking in this area. Catholics have become lazy. They've wanted to outsource their decision-making process to somebody else. At least some Catholics want to do that. Other Catholics could care less. But good people who want to be faithful, who want to not fall into the Protestant pitfall of private judgment, right? They want to be able to look to an external authority for guidance. And that's a very healthy, necessary Catholic instinct. Newman defends that very, very persuasively. But there's a right way and a wrong way to outsource your conscience, as it were. In fact, you can't outsource your conscience to another.
Yeah. So what I want to do, just for people who are watching or listening to this, I want to the plan here is I want to give strong, try to give strong arguments against Dr. Kwasniewski's position here, because I think it allows it to come out some, because this is something that good Catholics are understandably confused about and trying to understand. And so we really need to bring out what it means, what we're trying to say when we're saying rethinking the papacy. What is the Catholic, what is the true Catholic understanding of the papacy? So before I get into that, though, the different kind of ways to criticize what you're saying, I first would just want you to define hyperpapalism. That's obviously somewhat of an invented word. Again, we so we need to make sure we have our terms correct. What do you mean? Because you know, the road from hyperpapalism to Catholicism, that title means a hyperpapalism is not Catholicism, obviously. So what do you mean by hyperpapalism?
Yes. Well, you know, Eric, some people have used the term ultramontanism in discussions like this to describe an exaggerated or an excessive deference towards the Pope or veneration of the person of the Pope, or a kind of blind adulation and adherence to everything the Pope says and does. The problem with the term ultramontanism is it's a historical term that could describe a legitimate movement within the 19th century church, in fact, a traditional movement against liberalism. And so in order to avoid any confusion with, you know, and getting into the weeds unnecessarily, I didn't use the term ultramontanism, but I coined instead this I think, more obvious term, hyperpapalism, as in really papalism by itself would have been enough, because the ism suggests, you know, making too much of it. But I guess for added effect, you know, the Greek hyper, you know, prefix really brings out the idea of to use a favorite word, a hypertrophic, you know, an overgrown reliance on the single figure and office of the Pope, as opposed to, let's say, a reliance on the whole body of the bishops together, all of whom with the Pope are successors of the apostles, or a reliance on the universal and ordinary magisterium, which crosses all the centuries, right? And which is also a measure for the Pope, you know, not something that he stands above. So it's only hyper if the Pope is somehow your one and only, you know, principle that trumps everything else, right? It becomes, in a sense, identified with Catholicism. And that, of course, is not Catholicism and never has been.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Playlist shuffled? Check. Drinks on ice? Check. Z-Biotics? Make the most of your time with friends by starting your evening with Z-Biotics, the only pre-alcohol probiotic designed to make those rough mornings after drinking alcohol a thing of the past. Z-Biotics is key for those who live for the moment. Visit ZBiotics.com to learn more.
So for, as an aside real quick, I do want to note, I really do like the term hyperpapalism, because for years I use like papolatry, and I get that is a little over the top. They're not idolizing. Most people who are hyperpapalists are not actually treating him as an idol to be worshipped. So that was probably not a great term. And also just ultramontanism, for the reasons you said, that's not a great term because it can be misunderstood. So I do like hyperpapalism. I think it captures it well. Now, okay, so here's the thing, though. A lot of Catholics today would say, is it really possible to overemphasize the role of the Pope? Here's an example from my own personal life. My father-in-law passed away, and God rest his soul, very good Catholic man, was not happy with what happened in the 1960s. Just, I mean, it's a funny story they tell, that like basically his parish in the 60s that he went to got more the liberal weird stuff going on. He'd just go find a more traditional one. Then when that one got weird, he'd go find the traditional one, until finally he couldn't find another one. And he just had to go to the local suburban parish, but he didn't really like it. But he gave the advice to his kids, and he was a man of few words, a great, good, holy man of few words. He would just say, follow the Pope. Just, you know, if you follow the Pope, you'll be okay. And I remember hearing that when I was engaged and then got married to my wife, thinking that is beautiful advice. It's exactly the advice I'm give to my own kids. And this was probably, 1990s, early 2000s. And I didn't think JP2 was perfect, but at the same time, I was like, if you follow the Pope, you'll be okay. And I think I even wrote in one of my old books something about that's a great advice for kids, follow the Pope. Well, I don't want to give that advice to my kids today, but a lot of people would say, hey, that is still good advice. I mean, what is wrong with that advice to follow the Pope? Because I think it would lead you astray today.
Sure. Well, I mean, look, let's just admit right from the start that ideally, if we have a good Pope, we should be able simply to follow the Pope. The problem is that 2000 years of Catholic history shows us that popes come in all different shapes and sizes, from saintly, heroically saintly popes to decent popes, to mediocre popes, to immoral popes, to popes with problematic doctrinal teaching. Now, granted, right, there's an incredible track record for the papacy. I mean, as I mentioned in the book, you've got a 2000-year continuous monarchy. There's nothing like that in human history, I guess, apart from the Egyptian pharaohs, but Egypt isn't around anymore. So that's a past example. But we have this 2000-year unbroken sacral monarchy, as it were, in which you have a superabundance of saints, far more than you should expect from any category of people. And you have very few really seriously problematic individuals that theologians and historians have to fight about and try to figure out how this happened, right? And so the point is that we should, our default position should always be to respect and follow our superiors in Christ, right? That should be the default of children towards their parents, of wives towards their husbands, of parishioners towards their pastor, of priests towards their bishop, and of everybody towards the Pope, right? This is the structure of hierarchy. It's divinely instituted. But we also know, right, how authority works. There are limits to authority. Any authority other than God's has to be subordinate to higher authority, to divine authority, to natural law. We talked about this a little bit when we had our interview about my book, True Obedience, right? Mm-hmm. And so, parents don't say to their children, you should obey me unless I contradict natural and divine law or ask you to injure yourself, et cetera, and start giving a whole code of exceptions, right? I mean, and neither does the Ten Commandments, right? The Ten Commandments says, honor your father and your mother. It doesn't start giving the exceptional cases where that breaks down. Similarly with husbands and wives, with pastors and parishioners and so forth. So, and yet it is always the case that there could be a breakdown where an authority starts to teach something either erroneous or ambiguous or ambivalent or dangerous, misleading, whatever the problem might be, whatever kind of problem it might be, or where they start commanding something which is unjust, which is injurious, which violates the rights that people have, maybe even rights that they have from divine law, right? And so, in a way, we have to be able to perceive, just by our faith and reason, we have to be able to perceive when there is a conflict of that sort that has arrived. We don't want it to happen. We pray that God will avert it. We pray for, and if it does happen, we beg the Lord for deliverance because we know we can't solve the problem simply by ourselves. But we can't simply be automatons who blindly follow whatever a particular leader is saying or whatever he's doing. We can't do that with any authority, not even with the Pope. Only God deserves that kind of absolute and total obedience in every situation.
Right. I think it's the devil's in the details, because I think even the greatest hyper-papalist today would likely say, yes, if Pope Francis said to you, go kill that man or kill that innocent baby or something like that, you're not required and you shouldn't follow him in doing that. In other words, you hear this a lot, that you do not follow the Pope or any superior in sin. And I think even the most extreme hyper-papalists would acknowledge that as a fundamental principle.
Well, yeah, but let me push back a bit on that. I'm not even really so clear that that's true anymore with real hyperpapalists.
I was actually going to use the example of the Pope wouldn't, if he told you to commit adultery, you wouldn't.
Yeah,
do it,
yeah, exactly. Well, that's what I was thinking about, right?
Yeah.
Let me just step back for a moment. Because, you talked about your father and his advice, right? In my book, in the first chapter, I talk about how I used to be a hyperpapalist myself. And it was because of the John Paul II phenomenon. He was a very charismatic figure. There was a kind of cult of personality. He was a bit of a globe-trotting rock star. He made us proud. He taught very clearly about certain things, especially conjugal and sexual morality. I mean, he was like a bolt out of the blue in the chaos of the church after Paul VI. John Paul II was really a heroic figure and somebody that many of us rallied around. Just think about the World Youth Day, events and so on. But there are two aspects there. The negative aspect is that, if you followed him more carefully, or that is to say, if you looked more closely into what he did throughout the long pontificate that he enjoyed, you did start to find problematic things as well as good things. You found the Assisi interreligious gatherings which are really bizarre, and his defense of them is even more bizarre than the events themselves. You find him kissing the Quran. What in God's name is that, right? I mean, and you find strange utterances about this or that topic, especially about, say, religious liberty, that every man has an inherent right to choose whatever religion he wants. That even includes that Catholics can have the right to give up Catholicism. I mean, that's impossible. That's completely contrary to not only church teaching in the past, but to reason itself. So there's a dark side to the pontificate of John Paul II, which I think is now much better known than it was during his illustrious career. And I think we could also see some weaknesses in Pope Benedict, maybe more in Joseph Ratzinger's theological writings prior to his pontificate, but even in say something like the encyclical Spes Salvi, there are issues with the way he describes hell and purgatory. I know we can't get too far into the weeds there, but my point is that it's never a healthy thing to simply pin yourself 100% to the program of a particular pope, which includes a lot of non-infallible material, a lot of opinions, a lot of theological opinions. Popes are very free nowadays with their personal opinions about everything from environmentalism to nuclear weapons to, the best way to solve, food crises. I mean, they talk about everything all the time in ways that are difficult, if not impossible, to see as magisterial, as really having some kind of, binding force on us. But let me just get back to John Paul II. On the positive side, in terms of his strengths as a teacher, as a pastor, if you were following his teaching, let's say on marriage and family, where he was really the strongest, I would just want to say he was definitely the strongest in that area. And he's one of the greatest popes we've ever had in terms of marriage and family questions. If you allowed yourself to be deeply formed by him over two decades, there's no way you could simply, when Pope Francis shows up, that you could simply drop that, right? And you could drop all that you learned, all the profound wisdom and all the truths that you learned from John Paul II, and just drop them. Drop Familius Consortio, drop Veritatis Splendor, and so forth, because Pope Francis now has a different approach and a different teaching in Amoris Laetitia chapter 8 or with the opening to contraception or whatever, right? So really the people who are hyperpapalists, they cannot allow themselves ever to be deeply formed by any pope ever, because they always have to have a sort of gingerly touch on whatever the pope is saying, lest the next pope come along and contradict it or undermine it, right?
Right.
So really, if you want to be formed by a pope as your teacher, then that's incompatible with this notion of the magisterium of the moment and the magical development of doctrine that keeps being invoked by the partisans of Pope Francis.
I think the hyperpapalist, though, would say, I know they wouldn't want to be called that, but we'll just, you know, we know who we're talking about here. I think that a couple arguments that they say, first of all, I do know some might not, but a lot of them would just say, okay, yes, at least in theory, they would agree that you can't follow Pope in sin or something like that. But they would say there's a big difference between that and kind of what you're saying, in that middle of where do we decide where we do follow the Pope, where we do not follow the Pope. And they're the number one place that most of them go to is Lumen Gentium 25. And so just for people, I know you're familiar with it, but I want to read part of it here because I want people to know this is a very important text that is used to say that, yes, you should follow JP2 when he's Pope, and then you should adjust your thinking for Pope Francis. In fact, I just literally today saw an article that was kind of basically saying that Americans have a hard time with Francis because they can't adjust their thinking to him, which is implying we're supposed to adjust. And so it's okay. Lumen Gentium is talking about, this is a document on the church for people who don't know from Vatican II. It says bishops teaching communion with the Roman pontiff are to be, so we're talking about bishops first, are to be respected by all as witnesses to the divine and Catholic truth. In matters of faith and morals, the bishops speak in the name of Christ, and the faithful are to accept their teaching and adhere to it with religious assent. This religious submission, and here's where we're getting this, the important part here. This religious submission of mind and will, religious submission of mind and will must be shown in a special way to the authentic magisterium of the Roman pontiff, even when he is not speaking ex cathedra. That is, it must be shown in such a way that his supreme magisterium is acknowledged with reverence. The judgments made by him are sincerely adhered to according to his manifest mind and will. His mind and will in the matter may be known either from the character of the documents, from his frequent repetition of the same doctrine, or from his manner of speaking. Let me just make sure people understand what is kind of being said here, because the argument they're making is people like you, Peter, and me, let's be honest, have a very minimalist view of the papacy that says you only have to follow him when he's speaking ex cathedra. But yet Lumen Gentium is saying the exact opposite. It's saying, no, it's not just when he's speaking ex cathedra. No, we have to give this religious submission of mind and will. That's the key phrase right there, to basically the Pope's teachings, to his magisterium, which that is given a very broad definition. I think if you pin them on it, they might not say, yeah, everything he says on a plane. But when he repeats something like it mentions here, like, and he does repeatedly talk about certain things like Amoris Laetitia. I mean, he brings that up all the time. The teaching on the death penalty, he's been very clear about. I mean, there's no question exactly what he thinks about that. He's made that clear. So it seems to fall under what Lumen Gentium 25 says. So why is it, as Catholics, are we ignoring what Lumen Gentium 25 says? Are we rejecting it, or are they interpreting it wrong, I guess is the right
question. Yeah. Well, there's a lot packed into that question. I think this is a good example of where a little learning is a dangerous thing, to use the old expression. There's a lot going on behind Lumen Gentium 25. So first of all, in context, it's talking about doctrinal teaching, not disciplinary matters. That's a very important thing. People can't just invoke that when they want to talk about, say, prudential policies of popes or liturgical reforms. So we're talking about matters of faith and morals in doctrine. The word that's translated submission in the English translation is a poor translation. The word in Latin, The meaning submission isn't even one of the meanings given for it in a typical Latin dictionary. It means respect, okay? It means respect. So then you have to ask, what does it mean for a person to give respect to what a pope is teaching, right? And there are some very good articles about this. Christian Brugger, Jeremy Holmes, Michael Cirilla, you can find these articles online that talk about Lumen Gentium 25 and really unpack, you know, the meaning of those words. This passage in Lumen Gentium is not talking about everything that is relevant to this matter of what the Pope teaches. So for example, is the Pope himself bound to anything, right? Is there anything to which the Pope himself must give adherence, right? It doesn't talk about that. That's not what it's talking about. It's talking about the Pope's subordinates. But it's a very interesting thing if you start to think about, well, now, what is it that the Pope himself is bounded by? What are the norms or the limits on what he himself can utter as a legitimate, authentic magisterial teaching, right? If it happened that, now, there are some people, some hyperpapalists, take the opinion of Bellarmine, really a kind of extreme version of Bellarmine, and say that God would never permit a pope ever to utter anything in public that is contrary to the Catholic faith. But I mean, that seems to me so absurd. I can't even, you know, I can't even take that seriously. I wrote, I mean, the second volume of my work, this volume, is just a catalog of one thing after another that Pope Francis has said and done that are contrary to known elements of the Catholic faith. Okay. So I don't buy this idea that God would never permit a pope to go off the rails. No, that's not true historically, and it's not true currently. But if a pope did go off the rails, and if he taught, for example, even if he didn't openly say, I'm contradicting, you know, the sixth and ninth commandments, but if what he taught was logically convertible with or logically necessitated the violation of the sixth and ninth commandments, then it could not be part of his authentic magisterium. And therefore, it could not be something to which we could ever possibly be obliged to give respect and adherence.
Okay, so in the, okay, there's so much that Francis has said, yes, you know, in his 9 years. And so even, let's take away all the plain comments, all the things, the support for weird political things, other stuff. And really, let's get down to two things, two examples, which I think most hyperpapalists would say, this is an example of a teaching, a magisterial teaching that you must give religious submission of mind and will to. Maybe it's not ex cathedra. And that is, of course, the teaching of Amoris Laetitia, which, you know, I mean, I had on Dr. Echevarria a couple weeks ago talking about this, but it basically saying that, yes, there are situations in which a divorced and civilly divorced and remarried couple could continue to have relations as a husband and wife, and they could receive communion. That was possible. Mm-hmm. And then the other teaching, of course, is on the death penalty, in which even the Catechism has been updated, mm-hmm, and it talks about it being inadmissible. He does not use the right word immoral. And some papal apologists have said, well, he's not saying it's immoral. He said it's inadmissible. It means a different thing.
Yeah,
I have a hard time with that kind of squaring that circle. But those are real. I mean, those seem, at least, yes, to a lot of people, to fall under Lumen Gentium 25, that we need to give religious submission of mind and will to.
Right. And what I'm saying is, I'm sorry if I can't please everybody about Lumen Gentium 25. What I'm saying is the Amoris Laetitia chapter 8 teaching and the death penalty teaching are both contrary to natural law and divine law and the tradition of the church, the unanimous, uninterrupted, unbroken tradition of the church. And therefore, they cannot be true and they must not be given assent. And therefore, they don't, Lumen Gentium 25 cannot possibly apply to them. It's like saying, that an authority has power to do everything that pertains to that authority. That is a true statement. That's a universally true statement. If there's something that doesn't pertain to the authority of a father or a bishop or a pope, such as controverting or overturning some element of the Decalogue or of the unbroken moral teaching of the Catholic Church, then it simply doesn't belong to their authority to do that. I mean, they're at that point, you know, they are contradicting the rationale of their own office. Now, how can we know that? Okay, this is an important question, right? We don't have to be sophisticated theologians with doctorates to figure out that there's a problem when a pope, the 266th pope, is the first one ever to teach that the death penalty is contrary to the gospel, contrary to the gospel. That's what he says. It doesn't say that in the catechism text, but it says it in the one and only source to which the catechism refers, namely one of Pope Francis's own speeches. This is what I call the magisterium of me, right? It's like, Pope Francis, what's your authority for that? Oh, it's me. Okay, well, great. That's a nice circular argument, isn't it? So 266th pope, first one ever to teach us about the death penalty. Well, if we're supposed to follow the pope based on the repetition of a certain doctrine, does it not count that there are 265 popes who've taught something either explicitly or implicitly by not teaching against it, and only one who's taught the opposite, right? With the point about Amoris Laetitia, it's even more obvious than the death penalty, right? So I'm sorry, but you know, you have to, if you're going to be a human being, that means a rational animal, then you need to use your reason, right? And everything that we read, everything we hear, and everything we judge is based on rational, on first principles of reasoning. What are those first principles of reasoning? Aristotle gives them. There are three. The principle of identity, a thing is itself and nothing else. The principle of non-contradiction, a thing cannot both be and not be at the same time and in the same respect. And the principle of the excluded middle, right? There isn't something in between being and non-being, okay? So when we use our reason, we can see a contradiction. We don't need to be, we don't need a pope to tell us that there's a contradiction when we see a contradiction. And in fact, our reasoning is presupposed to receiving anything from the church, you know, whether it's a catechism or whether it's the teaching of a council or an encyclical or the Summa Theologiae of St. Thomas or whatever it is, right? Our reasoning is always presupposed. Now, we can be wrong in a particular case of reasoning, but we can't escape the need to use our reason and to use our faith-informed reason to reach conclusions about what we can and cannot accept and what we may and may not do, right?
I think the argument against that would be,
There's no argument against it, because the moment somebody starts arguing, they're using their reason. Do you see what I'm saying?
I mean, the argument against is that it's not violating that they are what France is doing is not violating reason, because these are developments that you just have the inability to see how it's not contradictory, but it's actually a development. Yeah. And you know, you read the arguments, like I have this book about Amoris Laetitia, where they talk about, well, what the Pope is doing is he's advancing classical moral, Catholic moral theology, and he's just developing it.
That's the argument. I know that they say that, but it doesn't, first of all, the real experts in moral theology who have studied these questions have shown very clearly what the contradictions are. I mean, they're as bold as night and day. I mean, there's a whole book. I don't know if I have a copy of it right here. I think I do. Yeah, it's a book that everybody who is serious about these questions needs to know, needs to get. It's called Defending the Faith Against Present Heresies, published by Aruka Press. This book lays out as clearly as possible, I mean, to the satisfaction of any rational being, that there are multiple points at which Pope Francis contradicts reason, faith, the prior magisterium, and so forth, explicitly contradicts them. And so, as far as I'm concerned, you know, the people you're talking about, they are mystifiers. They're making the papacy into magic and saying the Pope can pull a rabbit out of a hat and call it development of doctrine, or he can pull, let's say, he can pull a dove out of a mitre. That's how I like to say it. So, you know, it's magic. It's a magic show. It's smoke and mirrors. You know what that sounds like to me? That sounds like a sect. That sounds like the Moonies. That sounds like the Mormons. Okay. You know, my wife is a convert from Mormonism. I know the way from talking to her and from, you know, experiences that I've had, I know how sectarians think. They say, shut off your reason. That's deceptive. And just follow what the great leader says. That's how all of these systems work. That's a perversion. That's an ideology. That's extremely dangerous.
Yeah, it does. Like, I mean, that is the argument, is that it's somehow a development. But I think people who understand what Newman, particularly when he wrote about development of doctrine, he made it very clear that it does not become something, a teaching does not become something that it isn't. Like, all of a sudden it contradicts the earlier one. Oh, and when you see Familius Consortio literally says that a couple that's divorced and married cannot receive the communion if they're engaged in marital relations.
Yeah, and John Paul II, and not just John Paul II, right, traces the impossibility of a couple continuing to receive communion if they're still living, you know, as husband and wife. He traces that impossibility to the divine law. I mean, that's a serious thing. It's not like, oh, this is a disciplinary matter, we can change it if we want to. So basically, this is what it comes down to, right? And I cannot emphasize this point often enough. If Pope Francis is right about certain things, then the whole church has been wrong before him. Right. It's not just a development. It's either he's right and the rest of them are wrong, in which case he's cut off the branch on which he's sitting, and we should just not be Catholics at all, because the church has been misleading people. In fact, the church has been treating people cruelly, with great cruelty, for century after century after century. Or Pope Francis is the one who's mistaken. And as far as I'm concerned, it's a no-brainer. Which hypothesis? I'm a Catholic. Therefore, I believe in the Catholic Church. I believe in its indefectibility. I believe in the infallibility of the universal order magisterium. And so I'm going to cut off that lame branch and not the rest of the tree. I'm not going to cut down the whole tree for the sake of the branch. How could that possibly make any sense?
Yeah, I want to move on from that form of hyperpapalism. But before I do, want to mention, I just saw this morning a tweet that I think encapsulates this. Somebody wrote, "Remember, Pope Francis praised the George Floyd protests." That was the whole tweet. And it was basically saying, like, therefore, I mean, the implication was, therefore, if you're Catholic, you also have to praise and support the George Floyd protests. I mean, there's so many things. It's impressive how many things you can get wrong in such a short tweet.
Because, yes.
I mean, it's like, first of all, what does it mean he praised them? What does it mean? Like, you know, what part of the protest did he praise? And of course, fundamentally to our discussion, yeah, who cares that he praised
yes.
them?
Yeah. And this is something I should mention too, right? One of the great problems of modern Catholicism, and by modern Catholicism, now I'm talking about like really a pretty, like more like 150 years period, that modern in that sense, is that, first of all, modern philosophy and the movement of modern culture has been towards irrationalism, skepticism, materialism, atheism. So there's been a real crisis of reason. And most people are not well trained anymore in how to use their reason, in even how to recognize a contradiction. All you have to do is look at Twitter for about 5 minutes to see people contradicting themselves and not even realizing it, right? And so the power of reason has grown weak and feeble right now. And so I think a lot of people don't even, I mean, I have a doctorate in philosophy. I've taught philosophy for decades. For me, logic is, that's the infrastructure. That's the skeleton of everything, right? Everything rests on logic. It's either good logic, sound logic, or bad logic, flawed logic, right? So we have to, so I think because of this attack on reason, that a lot of Catholics no longer feel confident in their reason or their judgment at all. And they want to outsource everything just to the external authority, as I said before. And so in a way they're actually looking to stop thinking. They just want to be told what to think and what to do. This is a bizarre thing, because no one in the history of Catholicism has ever considered that to be the model of an adult Catholic. An adult Catholic is one who knows his faith, loves his faith, lives his faith spontaneously from within, with a real connatural sense of what it is, not just sort of waiting for the latest bulletin to come out to tell him what to think and what to do. You can't even live that way, even if you wanted to, right? If you put that together with this kind of inflation of the magisterium, where, lay people, they don't often read scripture. They don't read traditional sources and documents like the church fathers, the doctors, the liturgical texts, and so on. Their only source of information for a long time now has just been what comes from the Vatican, what comes from Rome. This is a very bizarre narrowing of what Catholicism is, what the sources of Catholicism are. I mean, frankly, Augustine, Aquinas, right? The prophet Isaiah, the Gospel of John, the Tridentine liturgy, these things have far more to do with what Catholicism is than Pope Francis's speeches have to do with it, Right. And so it's strange. If you cut yourself off from the sources, you sort of lose the ability to recognize what is and what isn't Catholic. Do you see what I mean?
Right. So, I mean, we've been talking about one part of the hyperpapalist camp, which is the people who like take Lumen Gentium 25 and make it basically, we have to just agree almost with everything the Pope says. And they always say, I'm not saying that, but then they literally agree with everything Pope Francis says. But then there is another group within the hyperpapalist camp, and it's typically Sedi Vacantinus, people who don't think Francis is the Pope. And if you look at, and they typically, what they do is obviously they're not going to go to Vatican II for their support, but they look at the era around, particularly around Vatican I and following Vatican I. They go back to Trent, even post-Trent days, but the focus is a lot on 19th century, early 20th century. And if you read, and I know you have, but like if somebody reads, for example, papal encyclicals from maybe the early 20th century, they do make statements, Pope do make statements that basically say, you have to agree with the opinions of the Pope. So then the Sede of the Continent says, well, obviously I can't agree because they have a decent Catholic sense of what it means to be Catholic. They say, well, I can't agree with what this guy who claims to be Pope, people are claiming to be Pope, what he says, therefore he's not really the Pope. Why is that something? Why shouldn't we go down that path? Because we do have church documents that are saying things like agree with the Pope in all things.
Right. Well, you know, this is going to scandalize some people. I'm sorry, I can't help you. I mean, this is why I wrote these books. You need we need to study and think about these things carefully. So, but in an interview, I have to just say it.
Right.
Popes are still human beings. They still have the strengths and weaknesses of human beings. They haven't been sort of divinized like the ancient Roman emperors, you know, used to be considered divine, right? The popes are human. And so they carry along with them the baggage of their own theological and philosophical ideas, their own cultural formation, whether it was whatever, however good or bad it was. And the Holy Spirit protects them from irrevocably committing the church to error and disaster. That is the strict interpretation of the indefectibility of the church as it applies to the papacy. That is, as it were, the minimalist reading of it. Not that the Holy Spirit is sort of, you know, the mouthpiece, the Pope is the mouthpiece of the Holy Spirit, which is what you get with some of these hyper-papalists, but just that the Pope is not going to be able to wreck the church and he's not going to be able to bind people to error permanently. Okay. That's what is guaranteed. Everything else, as far as I'm concerned, is fair game, right? So what does this mean? This means that a pope himself could have an exaggerated notion of the implications of his own authority, and he could even express that the way that Pope Francis expresses all kinds of verbal, you know, gas all the time. The pope could say, you know, I'm the supreme monarch of all creation. You know, all knees must bow before me. Everybody must agree with every single one of my opinions and whims. But he would not be correct for saying that and for thinking that, right? I mean, in other words, if he's not going to teach ex cathedra that that's the case, which no pope has ever even come close to doing, then his opinion is his opinion, right? And if the opinion is one that on the face of it makes sense, you know, there's nothing in it that kind of, you know, that rubs against what Catholics know to be true from other prior authoritative sources, then of course you could go along with it. But, you know, when there are times when Pius X says things that make it seem as if he is saying, I am the only authority in the church and no one can question me for any reason whatsoever. Well, that's actually false. So that has to be false for the reasons that I've given earlier and that I give in my book. So do you see what I'm getting at? That, you know, the fact that the Sede of Acontis can quote all of these things really only proves that they have found a certain vein of ultramontanism, of really extreme papalism that has almost no parallel in the rest of the history of the church. And they're going to milk that for all it's worth and basically say, well, look, since we don't have a pope that lives up to this, and we haven't for 60 years, by the way, then we obviously have no popes. We've just been abandoned. God has abandoned us. He has not provided a pope like Pius X or like Leo XIII. And so we are just on our own. We're just on our own. And at that point, I'm sorry, but that doesn't seem much different to me from the Protestant notion of an invisible church, you know, that right. We all like the church is just whoever believes. And in this case, the Catholic Church would be the small sect of people who believe that the Pope is this sort of heroic God man figure who never teaches error, never misleads, never does anything. It can't even possibly do that. And so they're just going to, I guess, be without a Pope forever. You know, I mean, I don't know what they're waiting for, how they're going to get out of that.
Yeah, I think what I find is that most Sede of the Continents, all of their proof texts come from typically from the 19th century, early 20th century. They might have a quote or two from Bellarmine and things like that, which is usually out of context. But so they have a great knowledge of that era. And if they follow what the popes of those days said, strictly, literally speaking, they have a point about, although they don't have a point that saying these popes today are not popes, but they have a point at least that of our attitude towards the pope, a hyper-papalist view. What I've always thought, though, is if you have a bit deeper understanding of church history, if you go back, even the most papalist Catholic in, let's say, the 13th century would never talk like, frankly, some of the popes did in the 20th century about papal authority. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, I feel like you have to take it and understand that there was a vein, like you said, within the church that did fall into hyper-papalism, that including the popes. And if you say, how dare you say that about a pope? Well, what are you saying about Francis, said Vicontina? So it's like, you know, we're making the same argument there.
And you know, take Pope John the 22nd, right? I mean, he's one example. He's not the only example, but, you know, he preached false doctrine. He preached an error. Let's just say he preached an error about the afterlife. It was a serious error, however, not just some kind of like incidental, trivial thing. And I mean, he said that the souls of the just would not be admitted to the beatific vision until the end of time. Well, that's a pretty serious error. And it certainly flies in the face of what had been taught earlier and then what was subsequently dogmatically defined by his successor, Benedict the 12th. But what happened when John the 22nd preached that? Did everybody just kind of bow their heads and fold their hands and say, we have to accept that? We better start rewriting the catechism? Did they say, you know, well, that's wrong, but, you know, out of respect, out of religious submission of intellect and will, we have to, you know, go along with what the Pope is saying? No, they opposed him. His theologians, Dominicans, Franciscans, they objected to him. They said, this is false. You have to recant this. There was a king who got involved, the king of France, who actually threatened the Pope and said, if you don't retract this, you know, you better retract this or else. I'm not really quite sure what he was threatening, but, you know, kings and emperors used to be kind of, you know, I mean,
their threats were real back then.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes they kept the church on track, even as other times they, you know, they led off into weird directions. So the point is that I think there was a healthier sense all around prior to the 19th century that the church is a body with many organs. It's a mystical body. It's not just all head, right? It's not just like this weird sort of alien body in which the head is enormous and all the other limbs are these sort of dwarfed limbs, like kind of lame, and they can barely even move and the head is everything. You know, that's such a twisted caricature of ecclesiology. Rather, in pre-modern times especially, you know, as I mentioned, kings and emperors, aristocrats, you know, religious orders, particular religious communities, bishops, these all were, it was like, you know, to use a cliche, it was like 1,000 points of light, you know, 1,000 points of authority spread throughout the church, which all interacted and intersected and worked together. But sometimes, as in the United States government checks and balances, sometimes they also were able to be checks and balances to one another, right? And you know, a pope could try to do something or to put something through, and at times it just wouldn't take, it wouldn't be accepted, right? So, you know, again, I think it's, one has to get into history more to see how bizarre the current configuration of things really is.
Right. Now, let's take it then the opposite direction for a minute. So you're arguing for a more minimalist understanding of the papal office when it comes to kind of defining things and telling us what to think and whatnot, that really does, I think we'd both agree, does, is not in keeping with what most, at least a lot of Catholics, maybe 100, 150 years ago would think of the papacy. But now what about, though, why don't you just go all the way, our Eastern Orthodox friends would say. And I've seen this argument a number of times, like about you in particular, that you're diminishing of the papacy, and I've had it against me too, but you're diminishing the papacy. It seems like you're arguing then for a more, why not rethink it to match Eastern Orthodoxy? Yeah. Why are you even bothering to keep the papacy if you're going to diminish it so much?
So the basic reason is that I have several fundamental theological objections to Eastern Orthodoxy that don't have to do with the papacy, actually. I have a serious problem with their view of purgatory, with their rejection of the Western view of purgatory on theological grounds. Mm-hmm. I have a serious problem with their teaching on divorce, where they're it's not even consistent. The Orthodox don't even have a consistent teaching on this question. They're all over the place, depending upon which branch or which national church or which bishop you or which source you go to. I have a problem with their autocephalous, nationalistic, ethnic, state-connected ecclesiology, which I think has been, I mean, it has sometimes per accidens been a benefit, but a lot of times it's been, you know, a crippling weight on them. Their tendency to Caesaropapism, you know, or Erastianism, you know, some kind of state church, and the sort of divisions that have resulted from not having a single visible head on earth. I mean, there is a reason why Christ made Peter the head of the band of apostles, and why the church, the ancient church, recognized the See of Rome as having a special status, right? It wasn't just a primacy of honor. That's baloney. There's no way you can get that out of the historical record, right? So, and then I have a problem with what they teach about the Immaculate Conception. I mean, I think what their denial of that is blasphemous, right? So I would never become Eastern Orthodox.
But what about their view of the papacy? Their view of the papacy for the Catholic Church, even if you don't take the other stuff?
I don't think, though, that, you know, their view of the papacy in a way is of a piece with the autocephalous ecclesiology. It's, you know, we will agree to be under a head until we decide not to be under a head. That is to say, it's a kind, I mean, they don't have, I think a fully consistent, worked out understanding of ecclesiastical hierarchy, which, I mean, again, the point at which I seem to be like an Eastern Orthodox is that I don't turn the Pope into a supreme absolute monarch. I mean, but I think that's not a view that has anything to be said for it on any side, right? Whether you're Catholic or Orthodox, right? But, you know, to simply go 180 degrees around and say, well, the Pope is just, you know, he's either only the patriarch of the West, or he's just a figurehead, or he's supposed to have some kind of honorific primacy, that seems to me like very weak, thin gruel. It's not adequate to the historical record. It's not adequate to the needs of ecclesiology. It's not adequate to a good theological account of the manner in which the ecclesiastical hierarchy should reflect the heavenly hierarchy. I mean, they themselves take that very seriously, right? The ecclesiastical hierarchy should reflect the heavenly hierarchy. Well, the heavenly hierarchy is a monarchy, for sure. So, yeah, those would be some thoughts. I guess the other point I would just make is this. You know, John Paul II and Benedict XVI both said on more than one occasion that it would be healthy for the Catholic Church to understand the papacy more along the lines of the first millennium, when the East and the West were united. Right? And however one interprets that, I mean, that's a pretty open-ended speculation, but there are some details that were given by both John Paul II and Benedict XVI. However that would look, you know, either you have to say it's legitimate for me to be entertaining these positions when two other popes prior to Francis entertained them, or you're just going back to the state of a conscience and saying, nope, we have to have this grand, you know, God on earth, absolute monarchy papacy of Leo XIII and Pius X, or we have no pope at all, nothing at all. And that's why they reject John Paul II and Benedict XVI as well. So I guess what I'm saying is, if you don't reject hyperpapalism, then I think you're either on the road to a complete subjectivist irrationalism, that's what I see at where Peter is, or you're on the road to state of acontism. That's it. There are no other options. If you want to be an intelligent Catholic, well-formed in the sources of Catholicism, grounded in all the centuries of the solemn teaching of the Church, then you need to reject hyperpapalism, and you need to recover a more sane, a more healthy view of it.
Okay, so if we have our two extremes on views of the papacy as a hyper-papalism on the one side, and let's just say Eastern Orthodoxy, I know it's not Catholic, but the point that you use as the other extreme, where essentially, yeah, there is a Bishop of Rome. He does have a certain primacy that's, let's just kind of give him a little bit of a title and stuff and look to him on some level. That's the other extreme. Mm-hmm. So where is that Catholic view, where's the Catholic view kind of fit in that in light of, you know, what Vatican I teaches? Because that's one of the issues a lot of people said when JP II and Benedict talked about recovering the first millennium, which I'm very attracted to, view of the papacy. But you got Vatican I staring you at the in the face saying, sure. And so where is that proper view in the middle there?
I wrote an article at 1 Peter 5 maybe a month or two ago called Vatican I as a Political Problem. And I recommend that to readers or to viewers, because in that article, I talk at one point about how Vatican I actually contains crucial teaching for limiting the papacy, right? People see it as a council that presented an unlimited view of papal authority. It did no such thing. First of all, in Pastor Eternus, it laid down very clear and definite lines within which the Pope exercises the infallibility of the Church, okay? But secondly, and more importantly, Dei Filius, the dogmatic constitution of Vatican I, Dei Filius says that the teaching of the Church on faith and morals can never be changed on the pretext of new understandings, basically the Hegelian Darwinian understanding of development of doctrine, which is all the rage now in Rome, and that's how they want to get, you know, they want to get an opening to birth control, you know, somehow as a kind of development from Humanae Vitae. However, they're going to do that, right? Vatican I cuts that off absolutely, completely cuts that off. So Vatican I, Dei Filius is actually saying, whatever the Pope does, it has to be within the continuity of the transmission of the apostolic deposit of faith. And that is something that how can we tell that? Well, because guess what? We have other sources of teaching besides the Pope. We even have other sources of teaching besides councils. I mean, amazingly enough, we have what's called the Universal Ordinary Magisterium of the Church. That is infallible. The Church herself teaches that the Universal Ordinary Magisterium is infallible. Well, what is that? Where do we see it? We see it, for example, in the witness of countless catechisms published over hundreds of years, over the last 1,000 years. You know about this project, Tratavox, right?
Yeah, it's right behind me.
Yeah, exactly. Tratavox. I've got it on my shelf, too. It's an incredible project. What are they doing? Well, they are publishing catechisms that were written. They were publishing catechisms that were written over a period of 1,000 years that all teach the same thing. Okay, that is the witness to the ordinary universal magisterium of the Church. That is what the Church has always held and taught through all of her bishops, right? And so once we recognize that there are other sources of knowledge, then we don't deny that the Pope is the Pope. We don't ignore him completely. We don't deny his office and his jurisdiction, but we see him as one part of a larger whole, as a preeminent but still part of the body of Christ to which all of us belong, and which all of us have been given the faith in our baptism, and we're soldiers of that faith in our confirmation. So this is something that concerns all of us. It belongs to all of us.
So essentially, the office of the papacy is a divine office. It is instituted by Christ for the Bishop of Rome, the successor of St. Peter. As such, he is the head, the visible head of the Church here on Earth, and so. But as an average Catholic, then we should look at him. I guess I want to kind of finish today by asking: okay, the average Catholic, how should he or she look at the Pope? Not necessarily Pope Francis. I mean, whoever the next Pope is, and look at what he says and does, and how should that influence their Catholic life?
Yeah, some people have objected that you know, if the only purpose of the Pope is to restate what the Church has already taught, then he would be superfluous. We would have no need for the Pope. But that's evidently false. What the popes have done for the whole history of the Church is repeated the past traditional teaching of the church at times when it was being denied or being undermined or being diluted or compromised in some way. The Pope is a remora, as John Henry Newman says. He's a barrier to novelty, a barrier to innovation, a barrier to progress in that sense, right? And so really, you know, it isn't superfluous for the Pope to repeat what the church already teaches, for him to do so even solemnly, if necessary, as when the Assumption of the Immaculate Conception was defined, you know, by the popes, right? So in a way, it may sound paradoxical to say this, but unless the Pope is going to, the Pope is there to confirm the brethren in the faith, as it says in the Gospel. And if it becomes clear to a well-informed Catholic that something else is happening, something's going wrong, he actually needs to keep a certain distance from that wayward Pope, just as has happened in some other parts of church history. You can see that in Roberto de Matteo's book, Love for the Papacy and Filial Resistance to the Pope. He needs to keep a certain distance and hold fast to the faith that was delivered once for all to the saints. That is, after all, what the papacy is for. It's meant as a bulwark against heretical innovations, right? I guess it cashes out practically as Jane and Joe Catholic should adhere to the faith as it's always been taught, as they get it in a valid catechism, as you can find it in the Catechism of Trent or the Baltimore Catechism or any of these other traditional catechisms. They should hold fast to their rosary, to their Tridentine Mass, you know, to all of the great monuments of tradition that we know to be blessed by divine providence and to be free from error and absolutely reliable. And, you know, if we can't solve certain problems, we shouldn't think that that means we don't know what to do, right?
Right. Okay. Well, I'm going to wrap it up there. I'll put a link in the show notes here to this book. It's actually a 2-volume work. So I say book, but it's really books. So The Road from Hyper-Papalism to Catholicism, Rethinking the Papacy in a Time of Ecclesial Disintegration. And the first volume, the subtitle is Theological Reflections on the Rock of the Church. So this is more of a general theological, like what are we, kind of what we were talking about today a lot, the general sense of how are we supposed to look at the papacy. So volume one, you can read either of these by or both. I say get both, but you know, they stand alone as well. And then the second volume is Chronological Responses to an Unfolding Pontificate. And this is more specifically Pope Francis, things he said and how we look at those in light of the theological reflections found in the first volume. So I would recommend people to pick this up. Again, it's Aruka.
Aruka Press.
Aruka. Thank you. Aruka Press. Thank you. Sorry about that, people who work there. I recommend getting it. Like I said, I'll put that in the show notes. I'll probably also put a link to my own podcast from last year about rethinking the papacy because we covered some of this. But I hope this was helpful for people because I think you think this too, Peter, but I do understand why this is a very confusing time for Catholics, why good, faithful Catholics struggle with the idea of in any way minimizing or diminishing or, like you're saying, keeping a distance from the Pope. That just doesn't seem to naturally sit with a lot of Catholics. And I get that. And that's why we have to talk these things through.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, the magnitude of the crisis is seen by the very fact that we have to have such conversations.
Right. Right. I think both of us, we'd both rather be studying some theological point from long ago or something. We don't really want to be talking about rethinking the papacy.
Right. Of course. I kind of see it as like when a building is burning down, everybody becomes a fireman, you know, to the extent that they can, you know, and that's what we're trying to do.
That's right. I got a little tiny bucket, but I'll do what I can. Well, thanks for coming on, Peter. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you, Eric.
Okay. Until next time, everybody. God love you.